Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. This week, I'm thrilled to welcome Daniel Lunowski to the show. Daniel is professor of history at the University of Memphis and the author of three previous books, as well as being the editor of Austrian History Yearbook. Most recently, his fourth book is a really wonderful new text called The Plunder, the 1898 Anti-Jewish Riots in Habsburg Galicia. The book is a close examination of the outbreak of violence that convulsed Galicia in the spring and early summer of 1898. In it, Daniel narrates the course of the violence and examines the way in which changing social, economic, and political conditions in the regions contributed. I'm thrilled to talk to him about the book. Daniel, welcome, and thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here and to take the opportunity to talk about my book with you and your audience.
So Daniel, we always start the same way. And so I'd invite you, maybe as we begin the interview, just to say a little bit about yourself and where'd you come from and how did you get interested in history and how did you get interested in Habsburg history?
Sure. I'm originally from New Jersey, which has, I guess, little to do with it. But the course of things took me to study history as an undergraduate student at the University of Michigan. And I was very drawn to history, and I took some classes with, among other people, a very charismatic professor, which is often how things go. Roman Szmorlach, a great figure in the field of Eastern European history. And that got me interested in that part of the world, Central and Eastern Europe. And when I finished my undergraduate degree there, I went to Germany for a while doing some language work and came back to the United States, bummed around, applied and had a Fulbright back to Germany again. And by the time I was ready to apply for graduate school, I was sure that it was really the Habsburg monarchy and not German history that I was most interested in. Questions of, again, maybe coming out of that experience with that charismatic professor, questions of identification, nationalism, the artificiality of these kinds of identities was something I found very interesting at the time and much more, to me, complicated and fascinating in the Habsburg part of Europe than in Germany. That's how I felt about it when I had to make that decision. When I applied for graduate school, I applied to Columbia University, where István De, a really leading figure in the field of Habsburg history, was the major person there. And that's what happened. That's where I ended up.
So your first couple books really deal with that kind of question of symbolism and patriotism and identity. Can you just kind of summarize for the listeners those kind of questions you asked in those first couple books?
Absolutely. Habsburg historiography, the approach is taken, let's say, to Habsburg history 20 years ago and more, looked at the monarchy as an obsolete construction, that in the age of modernization, of industrialization and communication and increasing literacy and department stores and so on, that the future had to be nation states and not empires, and that meant the Habsburg state was doomed to eventual destruction with the rise of nationalism. My book, my first study, my dissertation, I should say, which became a book, was part of, I think, a whole wave of new ways of thinking about the state, not thinking about its inevitable destruction, but about what held it together and how it functioned. My particular contribution to that was about how the dynasty itself served as a symbol of unity among the peoples of the state, what kind of ways that patriotism was promoted and how it was received to some degree, certainly by different parts of the population. So that's what that first book was about, based on my dissertation called The Pomp and Politics of Patriotism, Imperial Celebrations in Habsburg, Austria. And my second book was a co-edited volume that I did with a colleague of mine who's now a professor in Salzburg, a British scholar. And he and I were doing projects that complemented each other as our sort of dissertation turned into our respective first books. And we put our interests together to create The Limits of Loyalty, a compilation of essays by ourselves and other scholars that also looked at the dynasty in different parts of the monarchy and how it was promoted and challenged also. Because we're saying we're not trying to replace the narrative of inevitable destruction with one of nothing but friendly, happy people either. And so that's why it's called The Limits of Loyalty. But nonetheless, we agreed, the two of us certainly, that this was a much more powerful force, a much more pervasive part of the culture of the state than had previously been recognized. So those were those two projects.
And in the years since, I don't actually know when you started this, but sometime in the years since, you became editor of the Austrian History Yearbook. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the yearbook and what it is and what you try and do with it.
Absolutely. So I've been editor, I think this is my third or fourth year, and the Austrian History Yearbook is, we would say, of course, I'm the editor of it, so I will say this, but it's the premier journal in the English language for Habsburg history and post-Habsburg. So although it's called the Austrian History Yearbook, and it has its roots actually in agreements and funding actually from the Austrian state in the 1960s, it's our writ, our mission is to really be the place where new and established important scholars publish their innovative studies and work. So it's really a kind of community builder among scholars of Habsburg history and post-Habsburg. And by post-Habsburg, I mean anywhere that after 1918 had once been part of the Habsburg.
So how did you get interested then in the subject of, and I'll just use this word now and we can problematize it later, but anti-Semitic violence in the Habsburg monarchy. How did that become a subject you wanted to pursue?
Sure. When I was all the way back when I was doing my dissertation research, one of the major parts of my study was looking at how the jubilees of Franz Josef, who became emperor in 1848, were celebrated. So, for example, most importantly, the 1898 50th jubilee, the 1908 60th jubilee. So while I was looking at newspapers and all kinds of other source material, I found some references to this violence in this part, Galicia, this northeastern province of the Habsburg monarchy. And I really had never read anything about that before. It was very surprising to me to come across something like this that really was not a very well-known part of scholarship on that period. So I always knew that I would want to come back to that and really study that as a second original sort of focus. And so when I was able to finally get the opportunity with time and space and family life allowed me to get back over to the archives for significant periods of time, this is what I turned to try and see just what happened, but also as a Habsburg historian, what the state and society of specifically of the Habsburg system, how this could take place, what the reactions were, and so on. So I came at it as a Habsburg historian. I think this is significant to how the book presents itself. I came at it as a Habsburg historian, not as a historian of the Jewish experience, or even a historian of anti-Semitism, not a scholar who spent decades on the study of anti-Semitism before this. So for me, I was most interested in how could this violent wave have taken place in a state that was a constitutional system, and then how did that system deal with the aftermath of violence? So those were the things, the center, at least, of my original interest.
So by way of introducing the book, maybe you could sketch out for us the wave of violence that's at the heart of your book. What happens in Galicia in 1898?
Good. The violence is connected, or so I argue in this book, to many other things, two important new factors. There are all kinds of things that were already there. But two new factors, important factors in the 1890s were first the spread of a new kind of virulent Catholic-inspired anti-Jewish sentiment, anti-Semitism, and the second, a new mass politics, which reaches this province in the 1890s as well. So those two new features playing off of each other create a different kind of context, and also, so I argue in the book, meant that the kind of momentary conflicts that took place here or there intermittently throughout the 19th century, every now and then, and then sort of disappeared but never became part of any waves of violence or anything that became let's say, central to the media of the day, that the dynamic between these new factors led to this this violent incidents being attached to and promoting, leading to other such incidents, creating this this wave of violence. So it, I mean, I don't know if you wanted me to map it out a little bit or not, but it. Sure. I could even be more specific that the first elections for the universal manhood suffrage curia in the half complicated Habsburg parliamentary system took place in 1897. So until that time, all voters who could vote were divided into four categories, and they each category, of course, the wealthier had more weight. And to even be in any of those categories, you had to pay a certain amount of taxes to qualify. So the minority of people could vote. So this fifth curia was added for everyone else. And so the peasant vote, the poor, the vote of the poor now counted for the parliamentary election. So there's a rise in organizing and mobilizing by peasant-oriented parties and parties interested in the small town and rural votes. So this is taking place in 1897. In 1898, there are two specific small, I don't know, we'd say off elections, because two representatives to parliament pass away. And so there are these two individual elections, and the violence is tied in some ways to these two votes. In preparation for them, there's a series of mass meetings, a constant electioneering in these areas in which rival peasant parties are denouncing their competitors as the tools of the Jews and so on. And again, that's the context where this violent dynamic takes place. And all of this reflected always in the rural press, which is reflecting what's going on and then being read by the few literate people and read out loud to others. So there's a kind of dynamic between the press and the violence. People read or hear about violent incidents elsewhere and come to believe that it's permitted. And so they continue violent actions elsewhere. So most of the incidents begin in sort of special moments when lots of rural people come into the small market towns of the region. These were towns that had regular market days, once a month, twice a month, and so on. And people buying and selling from the countryside would come in. Very often the central squares would be filled with booths. Most of the people selling and buying things in those booths were Jews from those towns themselves. And so this interaction, bringing the rural people into the town, this economic relationship between buyers and sellers always creates the potential for tension, right? But when a violent incident begins and then people spread out from those places back to their homes and all of this is reported on the media and so on back and forth, the movement of attacks goes from these towns back out into the countryside and then continues to spread from there. So yeah, so the marketplaces also for special Catholic holidays when people come into these towns for church services and then leave them and begin looting Jewish businesses. But there's also a few incidents of new, specifically, or at least attempted efforts to create Polish national commemorations or festivals, which are drawing peasants into the towns, and then violent incidents take place. And as the peasants go back to their home villages, they bring that experience of violence back again. So that's the kind of way it flows anyway.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about the new form of politics, and you mentioned the growth of Catholic anti-Semitism. Let's back up to that just for a second. And so is this growth of Catholic, and I guess I'd say two things. One is the growth of Catholic anti-Semitism in this region distinctive to this region, or is it largely picking up on the same kinds of themes and concerns that are identified and elevated across the continent?
Right. So it's both picking up themes elevated and identified across the continent and specific things going on in Galicia itself. So, for example, it's not the invention of a Catholic anti-Jewish attitudes, of course, in this period. But beginning in the early 1890s, the Catholic Church in Rome, the Jesuit press in Rome, is writing and talking about the need for a Catholic response to modernization against the godless socialism and secular liberalism, that there has to be a Catholic social activism, right? And this becomes translated in the Galician context into an activism specifically directed against the Jewish population. So, for example, in 1893, there's a Catholic Congress that meets in Krakow, and out of that comes a sort of agreement by those who participate to boycott Jewish businesses, Jewish economic institutions. It doesn't mean people all over the place actually do boycott, but it means the boycott is promoted, and newspapers and new associations and organizations come out of this Congress all of them are focused, at least in part, on this idea that a Catholic modernization has to be, at its essence, anti-Jewish. Right? So that's one aspect of why it happens in this period. And this new electioneering, what happens there is that new peasant parties use this sort of pamphlets and materials created by these new Catholic newspapers and institutions and bring that to their audiences as they do their electioneering. So an example of this that I write about is a particular pamphlet called The Jewish Secrets or Tajemnice Żydowskie, which is written by a priest who was a catechist in Krakow. He writes this work, which he calls a work of asemitism. He says Catholics can't be racist anti-Semites because baptism has to be able to wash away the sin and convert the sinner right to Catholicism. But asemitism is a program to live and be entirely freed of the Jews. So to have our children not go to Jewish schools, to not buy and sell from Jewish businesses, and so on. And this pamphlet, which also draws on older themes of ritual murder charges and supposed Talmudic license for Jews to kill Gentiles and all kinds of other things as well, this pamphlet is then reviewed positively in the partisan peasant press, which is also involved in this electioneering. This particular peasant party, the Catholic People's Party, the Christian People's Party of this, headed also by a priest, Father Stanisław Stojewski, brings this pamphlet with them to some of their rallies and passes it out, sells them in cheap copies and so on. So it brings this Catholic anti-Semitism, which is a pan-European phenomenon in the period, but brings it right to this local level. So that's just one example of that. Yeah,
I was really struck by the frequency with which, and I think you refer to them as tap rooms, which I'm assuming is a kind of bar, cafe kind of thing. I was struck by how often that Jewish institution came up in the complaints were aired by the non-Jews who you write about.
Certainly there was a great, maybe this is something I should add now, which has touches on that there's a very, very visible social, cultural, and economic divide between Christian and Jews in this particular area at this particular time. So Jews in this particular area were overwhelmingly involved in petty commerce and trade. A great symbol of that are these, as I said, these booths and stores that line these small market towns, very often owned or administered by Jews, or the tap rooms, right? These really astounding number, thousands of small saloons. I don't know what other term to use. Some are taverns with real restaurants. Some have rooms you can stay in as sort of hotel guests. Some are just windows that open up and you can buy vodka and sausages through it. So there's a whole range of what these things are, but there are thousands of them. There are tap rooms like this in almost every village, sometimes two or three, even in small villages. And about 80%+ of everyone in Galicia who was involved in the alcohol trade were Jews. So this creates a certain kind of profile, economic profile, that's very different from the overwhelmingly agricultural non-Jewish population. Right. So that's very, and then that's even more visible in terms of when you think of the dress. Right. Here is a region which is still a very visibly Hasidic. It doesn't mean everyone is a deeply religious Hasid, but Hasidism is still very powerfully visible there. So Jews often are dressed quite differently. They're speaking Jewish on the street. And very obviously in these small towns, their pattern of everyday life, weekly life, revolves around the Jewish religious calendar, very different from the Catholics. And I have, among other things, I always like to use as many images as I can. And one of the striking images that I have in my book is from, they're certainly idealized images, no doubt, but it's from a volume published in 1898 from the Austro-Hungarian monarchy in Word and Image, a famous series produced under the patronage of, by this time, the dead from suicide, son of the Emperor Franz Josef, that shows pictures of peasants and Jews from, or illustrations, I should say, of peasants and Jews from this area. And you can get a sense of just how different people seemed to be. That difference doesn't have to mean that people perceive that as danger versus just the lay of the land and how things worked, right? But this Catholic anti-Semitism, this political mobilization was bringing this idea that Catholic Jewish difference was a difference that was threatening.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, let's talk about the violence itself. And I think often when you say anti-Semitic violence, people assume that there is a wave of killing. But actually very few Jews die in this violence. So can you say what kind of violence this was and what kind of impact it had?
Sure. Actually, no Jews are killed in the violence. The people who die, who are killed, approximately 20, it's hard to add it up from the sources that I have and be 100% sure, but something like 20 people are killed, and those are all people shot down by the gendarmes and the military to protect the population from rioters. So it's a very different experience than what happens in the Russian Empire. This is why, me as a Habsburg historian, this is quite an interesting aspect of the events. But that doesn't mean that the confrontations between Christians and Jews in these villages and towns weren't frightening and dangerous, right? Sometimes the confrontations were as simple as rocks being thrown in windows. Other times, break-ins into synagogues, trash, Torahs thrown into the mud, sort of symbolic violence, if you want. Sometimes crowds of people surrounding Jewish homes and blowing on horns and pounding together metal instruments to make loud noise for hours at a time. What in German is called Katzenmusik, I translated this caterwauling. But also very personal confrontations between people who knew each other, who lived in the same villages with each other, who would come to the tap room they know and have frequented, insist that they be given vodka, and then after drinking a while, trash destroy the inside of the tavern, sometimes burn it down, sometimes beat severely the Jewish owners and their families, humiliate some people. There are examples, of course, of humiliation, forcing people onto their knees and other things like this, pulling beards, but a lot of punching, a lot of hitting with sticks. That's the level of most of the violence. So it was certainly dangerous and frightening, but there was seems to be here, right, a line that people didn't cross, right, that they did not move into the killing, which, of course, we see when we come down, even in this Habsburg, post-Habsburg space, when we come down to World War I and beyond. But here, during the Habsburg period, it stops short of murder.
So you actually talk about the existence of communal violence in the Habsburg Empire before 1898. How similar is this violence in Galicia to the kinds of violence you see in other places in the empire?
Good. Well, the other examples of violence, at least in these decades, can't really be that well compared. They're intermittent. They're short moments of sort of famously Czech and German students fighting on the streets of Prague, for example, things like this. In Galicia, there were some moments in specific places in the 1890s as well, where there were confrontations largely between railroad or mine workers and Jews who were seen as, again, economic oppressors in some way. And those incidents were short, one day, 2 days, and that was it. So this is very different than any of those in that this went on for about 5 weeks or so. Not everywhere for 5 weeks, but all together for about 5 weeks in over 400 locations. Again, these are locations anywhere from tiny little towns of a few dozen people to, or villages, I should say, to larger towns of several thousand people. So very different kinds of locations, but in this sense, it's quite different.
So who is it that commits the violence? Is there some kind of pattern among the perpetrators? And what kinds of people are either, and is there a distinction? You draw a distinction between the people who kind of lead the violence and people who follow. So maybe you can say a little bit about that.
I try to do that. In my effort to try and see what is motivating the people who are most active in the violence, and they seem to be different kinds of people and motivated by different kinds of things. I know that's a wishy-washy answer, but some of those who are the most active leaders of violence, and here by this I mean who are gathering people together, who are the first to break in or start smashing something or start physically harming a Jewish person. Some of these are people who were among the smaller numbers of literate people in the countryside who have read some of this Catholic literature or some of the pamphlets and newspapers produced by these new political parties. So there we see some direct ties to these things I was talking about. Others are young people who were, let's say, followers or went to attend a particular priest's church, and that priest himself was involved in this kind of politics and so spoke in its sermons about the Jews in certain ways. Others were people who were leaders of their villages, so might have brought or been among a group of people who come to town for market day or for one of these kinds of new festivals or a Catholic festival, and then been involved in some kind of violent moment and then yell, it's permitted, it's happening all over the place, now is our time to do the same. And because these people, someone like this, is seen as a leader in their local village, quite a few others accept that leadership at that moment and join in, and that spirals around. We also have some incidents of local policemen who are involved in gathering and leading violence. So there are also some of the most violent moments are people who themselves saw this as a moment of personal revenge. One specific incident that's coming to my mind is where someone beats a particular Jewish owner of a farmhouse and tells everyone around him, this guy has a lot of money, let's plunder. And the reason he knows or thinks he knows about this particular Jewish person's finances is because this person bought the bankrupt farm from him. He had gone bankrupt, and this was the person who now owns the land he once had as an independent farmer. So sometimes it's revenge. Other times it's criminal elements who have long criminal records, who see the sort of chaotic moment of violence spreading as a moment when they can do something as well. Right? There doesn't seem to be connections for some of them to the new anti-Semitism or these new political movements. They're not necessarily leaders of communities, but here is a moment they can steal some vodka, some other things, indulge themselves in some violent lashing out. So there's all kinds of motivations going on. But and all those things are there in other moments in time. But what happens again here is that there's a dynamic that these things are reported on. Their news is spread about them by the new political movements, by the new press, which is expanding in this period at this particular place and time. And people read about what happened elsewhere, right? And they read that people elsewhere beat Jews and claimed this was permitted by the emperor. And so that by reading that reporting in the newspaper, people then claim that's proof it is in fact permitted to us to do that. So, yeah. So I guess that brings up one of the other important elements here, which is this question of rumors of permission. Because behind so much of this violence is the, at least the pervasive, a news or claim that the emperor or the pope has permitted peasants to beat and rob the Jews for certain periods of time. And some of these stories are rather colorful and outlandish. Some of them spread around that, that the emperor's son, who again had committed suicide a decade before, was still alive and in Brazil and was calling on the peasants now to beat the Jews to help him regain his heritage. Maybe the most colorful of all was a rumor that the Jews had bribed the Pope's barber, the man who seemingly was responsible for Franz Josef's famous mutton chop beard style, that that this barber was bribed by the Jews to slit his throat when he's cutting or shaping the emperor's beard. But out of patriotism, he cries and refuses at the last moment, admits to the conspiracy to the emperor, who then gives his permission for the Jews to be beaten. So one of the questions is, did people really believe these kind of rumors? And how can we know that? Or did they just use them? Did they shape them for their own benefit? And here I'd say yes to both of those things. There's quite a bit of evidence that many people believe those rumors. So an example, in one particular town, Kavadia Zebshadovska, a man in a store, I saw a store owner, had been stocking a new, a new chemical, which was supposedly effective at removing ink stains from clothing. And the company that got him to stock it gave him some advertisements. And the advertisement said, you know, this new product is, removes ink stains. Well, the word that was used for ink stains, jid, is the same word for Jew. I don't know enough of the etymology why that's used for ink stain. But to an illiterate or half-illiterate crowd, this became a ticket giving people permission to attack Jews. And this store owner said quite a few people came in asking for tickets to beat the Jews. But that's just one example where, yes, people, some people certainly believed that there was some kind of permission, some kind of allowance to do this violence. Others may have just put different pieces of the sort of canon of rumors spreading around together in different creative ways for their own benefit, that they wanted to have violence at a certain moment. So they took pieces of what they had heard together and create a new rumor that violence is about to occur. And then when it does, the rumor is proven true, of course. So,
how do Habsburg authorities respond to the violence?
Good. Well, the Habsburg state, this was the part that originally had drawn me to this, again, not as a scholar of Jewish history or anti-Semitism per se, but how does the state deal with this? And of course, what is the state anyway in the Habsburg monarchy? Because it is two states, and more than two states, and less than two states. There's Austria and there's Hungary. There's the cabinet in Vienna and the central ministries. And then there's the governor's office in each province and its own underlings in each county, these district captains. Meanwhile, there are municipal autonomy. So in big towns and even small towns, there are people who are representing the people there in different positions of leadership. So it's very complicated to say what the state response is. But certainly in Galicia, the governor of Galicia, who was newly appointed and really is subject to the Ministry of the Interior in Vienna and through there to the emperor, certainly was concerned and started early on calling for increases in gendarme patrols. He starts asking the military to lend him military assistance and deploy some troops in certain places. But his response was limited, believing that this will blow over until near the end of June, when there was a whole series of really mass urban, these are small towns, but mass riots in towns in Novi and Stari Sonch, for example. Literally thousands of people were involved in these riots in the village of Lucha. In this period, at least 800 people surrounded a Jewish tavern and were involved in that violence. And in at least one incident, some people fired on Habsburg troops and then ran into the forest and were not apprehended. So there was a belief in the last week of June that things had gone beyond what normal measures could control. And the governor of Galicia asks and receives permission from the Minister of the Interior, Thun, and Franz Josef himself to declare a state of emergency, which is declared for 33 counties in the western half of the province. And two judicial districts are actually put under a special tribunal, or we might think of as martial law. A very dramatic moment where representatives of the governor's office and the military blow trumpets in the square in these two towns and announce in a very formalistic way that there is a special tribunal here, and anyone who's caught in arson or robbery will be tried almost immediately and sentenced and executed with no possibility of parole. So that never happens, by the way. They don't execute anybody, although the chief executioner, a man named Carl Zeilinger, who was part of a family line of hangmen. The chief executioner of Vienna was sent to Galicia, and the news was spread about that, but it was really a deterrent more than anything else. So what did the state of emergency mean? Well, it meant that most of the constitutional protections that in a way made the Habsburg monarchy a very different place from somewhere like the Russian Empire. So freedom of movement, freedom from arbitrary arrest, postal secrecy, freedom of the press, and so on. All of these things were suspended. Even jury trials were suspended in order to get a grip on the violence. Thousands of military troops were deployed. Control over them was handed over to a general who believed he could whip things into shape in short order. And then after this moment, which really is declared the state of emergency on June 28th, follows then this long series of investigations and trials that go on for months afterwards.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the trials. How did the accused try and explain their actions in these trials?
Good. It's interesting because they explain it in ways that at least attempt to shift. Well, it's not that surprising, right, that an offended attempts to shift the blame from themselves onto their victims, right? So the defense attorneys, I should say, more than the defendants, use this tactic where they say that they don't deny that their clients are drunkards and illiterate, many of them, although not all of them, by the way, by far. But this is what the attorneys say. My poor, drunk, illiterate clients are fooled by the press reports about rumors of imperial permission. They're just too innocent to understand reality, and therefore they did these things. And they add to this that proof of the Jews' corruption, a corruptive influence, let's say, in the countryside, is in fact that reality, that the peasants are drunk always from the Jewish tavern and are kept stupid by Jewish power and are dependent on Jewish credit. And so that's what you get. So actually, this violence only proves the guilt of the Jews themselves. So this is the main focus, I think, of the defense in many of these trials. I mean, there are scores of trials. So some of them are just about a couple of people who are drunk or get drunk at a tap room in between villages and just threaten the tavern keeper and say, if you don't give me free alcohol, I'll trash this place like every place else is getting trashed, right? So they take advantage of that. Maybe they'll trash, or maybe they'll hit someone. But those trials are short. But the bigger trials that last and have many more defendants there, these defense attorneys use this kind of tactic, that the whole thing is just proof of the guilt of the Jews, right? That all of it really was nothing that big. It was just some drunk people kept ignorant by the Jews who lash out. It's picked up by the Jewish-controlled press in Vienna and spread around the world that we are backward barbarians, and so on and so on. So everything is the fault.
So let me follow up with that by saying, how many of the people who were accused, how many of them were convicted, and what kind of punishments did they face?
Okay, so of the 5,000 or more people who were investigated and charged, and that's not everybody who was arrested by far, and that includes Polish-speaking peasants and day laborers and construction workers, but also city council members and shopkeepers and people in their 70s, men in their 70s, even 80s, right? Women of all ages. Almost 4,000 actually went to trial, about 3,800 people, and more than 2,300 people were sentenced. to time in jail served or to prison terms. So those sentences were anywhere from a few days to the longest sentence I saw was 3 years. That was very exceptional. But there were many sentences of people for 5, 6, 7 months and more. Those who especially were violent personally toward Jews received, it's not surprisingly, the longest sentences. So that said, one thing I should point out is that as much as that makes the Habsburg state look like it is the good guy here, right, suppressing violence, acting to restore the rule of law, that doesn't mean the state saw it as part of its job. Anti-Semitic rhetoric, for example, the prosecutors in their indictments themselves, in some of the most well-publicized examples, wrote that, in this, the reason peasants hated Jews here was because they were so exploited by the Jews, or the Jews are so corrupt here, or the Jews are so exaggerated in their claims of fear and their fear of violence. And things like this are there in the prosecutor's indictments. So even as the state is restoring order, they are distancing themselves from being seen. The state's agents don't want to be seen as taking the Jews' side exactly at the same time.
So we're running close on time. So let me kind of, there's much more to this book, I should say to the listeners. And Daniel does a really nice job of thick description and talking about the violence and kind of parsing out motives and actions. And so I really recommend that you go look at it. So what is the legacy? Let's conclude by saying, what are the legacies of this violence for the Habsburg Empire?
Good. I mean, the Habsburg Empire, after the 1867 compromise, which turns it into the constitutional double state of Austria, Hungary, set in stone protection of people based on religion, secured their rights. And yet here, in order to preserve order, the state has to set most of the constitutional rights aside. So what we see here is, in order to protect the Jewish population, the state has to deploy the military, end freedom of assembly, at least for a time, freedom of the press, and so on, which if you want to talk about lessons, some Jews at the time were pleased to see the state embodied in Franz Josef, the benevolent emperor, and so on, protect them. Others thought, well, this is not such a great situation if you need the military and the gendarmes backed by the central state to protect the Jewish population. So certainly, when scholars look now at the end of the state and the fading away of loyalty during World War I and the blunt force of the military and its deeming of different populations as disloyal during World War I, it's setting aside its whole purpose, the Reichsstaat, the state of that rules by law. We can see this as, in some sense, a precursor. In this moment of emergency, the state has to act in ways that actually threatens the loyalty of the population. It can't look like it's protecting the Jews. People come here to be suspicious of state action. The political figures damn the state, declare themselves the protectors of constitutional values against the arbitrary power of the central government. So I think when we look toward World War I, we can see here some problems with the system that will become, obviously, fatal issues during World War I.
And then is there a legacy, or what is the legacy? What is the, how does this pattern of violence in this particular region at this point in time, how does this fit into the broader, evolution of Jewish-Christian relations in Central Europe or Eastern Europe? What is there anything we can learn from it in that respect?
Well, certainly something that looms large here is that here is the first moment of mass politics coming to the countryside, the public-speaking countryside, and it comes with anti-Semitic violence. And the question of the Jews and relationship with Jews and Catholics and how to become modernized in ways that work for the Catholic peasantry, all of these things are very politicized from the first moment. There's an important, to me anyway, quotation from a newspaper printed in Lemberg or Lviv, Lviv, the capital of the province, which says to the readers who don't want to call themselves anti-Semites, well, you can do that, but if you don't call yourself and embrace anti-Semitism, you're not really a Catholic and you're not really a Pole. And so what's dangerous here is defining of quote-unquote Polish Catholic political interests as in absolute opposition to the Jewish population. And that is a legacy that political figures who are involved in this period will carry with them into the interwar. I don't want to make a direct connection, although some listeners will hear the echoes of this, from this to the neighbors' violence of 1941, neighbors, this famous book about Polish violence on Jews during the Holocaust, beating and killing their own neighbors, right? Jan Gross's famous book. And here in 1898, we have neighbors who lived in the same villages beating up and plundering their neighbors' businesses, taverns, and only stopped by the state of emergency of the state. And they're told by the politicians most interested in their vote that you are not to blame. To blame ultimately is the Jews themselves. I mean, I think this is very ominous for the future of the region, as we see, of course.
So that seems a good place to stop. And so I always end with the last couple questions in the same way. And so the first one is, you've done an enormous amount of reading, both specific to this book and about the region in general. Is there a book or two or a documentary or a film? What would you recommend for listeners that was meaningful to you as you were writing this book?
Mm-hmm. I think some things that I could recommend really on the topic of, let's say, Jewish Catholic relations in this period, in Polish history generally, Joanna Michlik's Poland's The Other, The Image of the Jew from 1800 to Present's very good. A very accessible newer book, Brian Porter Schutz's Faith and Fatherland, Catholicism, Modernity, and Poland, gets right at this question of Catholicism and Polish national identity, and of course, the place of the Jews. One other one that I'll mention as a scholarly book would be Glenn Dinner's Yankel's Tavern, which is really about an earlier period in the Russian partition of Poland, but it still certainly is relevant to what I'm talking about. I could certainly give you a more scholarly suggestion as well, but that if you want, I can. I don't want to overwhelm your readers at the same time.
The second question, is always the same. What are you working on now?
Good. I am actually approaching a new project. I've done some preliminary research on it, which is the history of the town and the beer brewery. It's Poland's most well-known beer brewery, of Żywiec, which is a town that's in Galicia. And the beer brewery was founded by a branch of the Habsburg dynasty in the 1840s and 50s. And this area, that branch of the family, after the collapse of the monarchy, became a Polish patriots and famously refused to join the SS when the Nazis occupied. And this region becomes a laboratory of Nazi ethnic engineering in World War II, where thousands and thousands of Poles are expelled. The Jewish population is exterminated. And German, supposed blood Germans, are brought in from Bukovina and from Galicia. to right into the homes of the expelled Poles and into the jobs in the beer brewery and elsewhere. And the brewery then makes beer for the German population and for the German army attacking into the Soviet Union. And after the war, the brewery is, again, a Habsburg family possession. Originally is nationalized, of course, by the Polish communist state, and then makes beer for export for hard currency, but is certainly a Polish communist product. And finally, after 1989, I think in the early 90s, actually, it's bought by Heineken. And now it's a foreign-owned beer with Polish roots that are Habsburg roots. So it's through this one town institution as a sort of lens into the complicated history of the whole region, into these dueling utopian projects, murderous projects of the Nazis and of the communists, but also the earlier period as well under the Habsburgs and in interwar.
I got to say, that sounds like a fascinating project. And I wish you well on it. And I hope when you're done, you'll come back to talk about the book with us on New Books Network. And until then, have a great end of the semester. I know you're about to launch into grading, so good luck with that. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Excellent. Take care. Bye-bye.